I'm an alcoholic. Okay. First, I want to thank Tim and Renee for asking me to come up here and do this. It's been a blast. I didn't get to come up until today, but I've had a lot of fun since I've been here. And also to Eric. Eric was my host. I called him my host, more like my keeper. He's the guy that I called. I said, well, call me when you get to town, and we'll take it from there. And I said, all right. So when I rolled in, I called this guy, and I'm sitting in my hotel room, and he comes walking in the door he's got a gift basket of stuff, and he's got flowers, and he's, here you go. This is for you. Come on, right? Jump in the cars, drive up here, shows me around. Real nice guy. If you don't know Eric, get to know this guy. He's a great guy. So I'm an alcoholic. Still amazes me sometimes. So what it was like? What it was like was it was terrible. It was terrible. I mean, everything in my life was fine until I was about five. You know, I had a good first little run there, and then I started sleepwalking and talking in my sleep, and I'd walk to the house in the middle of the night, stand at the foot of my parents' bed and talk stuff, scare the shit out of my parents, turn around and walk back through the house and get back in bed. And they decided that I was obviously an extremely disturbed child and I needed some attention. And they took me to a series of, it's a friend of mine over there and she knows me. Took me to a bunch of psychiatrists and they decided that the answer was every night when I go to sleep, they'd give me a tablespoon of this liquid stuff. I'd drink this down, it'd knock me out. No more problem. No more sleepwalking. So I think subconsciously, at a very early age, I got the information that if things aren't going the way you want them to go, take something and make it better. So I sort of filed that for later. And fast forward to 12. 12, my father decided I should become a man. It's time to become a man, which was a joke, right? I mean, I was, you know, 5 feet tall, 100 pounds. I did not have a clue, right? I had no tools for living. I didn't need any. I got up, I went to school, you know what I mean, which I walked to school up the block. I had a couple of friends, I had a dog, I had mom, dad, my sister, you know. I mean, how many tools do you need for this? You know, it was covered, you know. And dad decides that I should become a man, which threw me. And I ended up being shipped off to this boarding school. And they deposited me in this boarding school. My father shook my hand and said, this will make a man out of you. And everybody got in the car and drove off. You know, and I just thought, wait a minute, man, something is really wrong here. The fact is, I was being given an opportunity for a wonderful education that would hold me in good stead for till today. The feeling was is that I'd just been thrown away by my family, and I had no idea what I'd done to deserve that. I was devastated, man. It paralyzed me with fear. And turns out I was the youngest kid in a school of 250 kids, all boys, all maniacs from all, they had scoured the earth to find the 250 most disturbed adolescents they could find, and they put them in this school. And I was the youngest kid in the school. Everybody in the school was a teenager, you know. Now, being a teenager is no big deal unless you're 12, you know. Then this is a very big deal. You're definitely the odd man out, you know. And also the littlest, and I needed some tools quick, right? And in the first week there, I started to develop my tools for living. This is Earl's best thinking. This is how I decided to handle life at age 12. This guy, Tiny, I met Tiny. Every school's got a guy named Tiny. You know, he's 6'2", 245, right? Stupid, right? And he came up. That wasn't nice. Tiny wasn't stupid. Tiny was a very bright guy. He was just an asshole. Tiny walked by and said, how you doing, punk? And slapped me in the back of the head and sent my books flying. I mean, I was afraid when I woke up, you know. I didn't need Tiny to, you know, put me right over the edge, right? And like I said, no tools for living. I didn't know how to deal with this guy. I had no experience with this stuff, right? And I had one of those out-of-body experiences that you have, you know, where you're watching yourself do something and your head's saying, this is a real bad idea. And it was me, you know. He smacked me in the back of the head. My books went flying. I turned around, walked up to him, jumped up and hit him as hard as I could. And then just stood there looking at him, you know. because I was past anything I knew anything about. I didn't know what was supposed to happen next. Hitting him didn't have any effect on him. I mean, there was no point in continuing that. And he just looked at me and he said, "You got a lot of guts." And then he beat the shit out of me. And I remember thinking while I'm taking this beating that this is going okay. This is going pretty good. You know, this is good. And the reason is that I am absolutely terrified of this guy. And he thinks I've got guts. He just told me so. Right? So I took my little beating, you know, and he went on his merry way. And word spread far and wide across the campus like that, right? Watch this little Hightower kid. He's crazy. He just assaulted Tiny, right? So now I got this reputation as this little maniac, which had absolutely nothing to do with who I was. I was afraid of my own shadow. I was afraid of everything, everybody, right? And now all these people are coming up, you know, wanting to be my buddy, right? Like I'm going to protect anybody, right? Like I'm this tough guy, right? But I'm learning tools for living, you know. Violence works, you know. And how violent I'll become in my life is directly contingent upon how bad you scare me. You really, really frighten me, I will become really, really violent. And that's got nothing to do with being a tough guy or a bad guy. It has to do with being a terrified individual. That's it. I'm not a tough guy to this day. Never have been, never will be. It's just not who I am. So I got my first tool for living. Then I met this other kid, Matt, who came up. So the cool guys, the hip guys started coming around. You know what I mean? They're like those little underground cliques that run in schools like that, right? Where you band together like packs of rabid dogs roaming the campus at night, you know? Matt comes up and says, "You want to smoke a joint?" I said, "Absolutely." You know? And I didn't even know what it was, you know. But somebody was saying, what I heard was, "You want to come with us? You want to hook up with us?" The answer was, "Yeah, I do." You know, they could have said, "We're going to go steal the principal's car and burn it." "You want to come?" I just said, "Yeah, absolutely. We're going to go kill the Spanish teacher. You want to come?" "Yeah, I'm coming." "Yeah. I'm all alone in the universe, man. I need to hook up. You know, whatever you guys want to do, fine. I'll just tag along." So we stop and we pick up Matt on the way. Matt pick up Steve on the way. And Matt had the joint. And Steve had this little container wrapped in tinfoil. And you could tell when we get around behind the dorm, back there in the trees, and you could tease her to opening this thing up, you know. And you could tell by the way he was opening this up, this is important. What's in here is important, you know. Very careful with this. Oh, and it was a little Tupperware container full of cheap red wine, right? I mean cheap. Red wine. It wasn't a grape within 1,000 miles of where they made this stuff, right? I mean, this is that fortified shit, you know? So Matt took a hit on the joint, and I took a hit, did what he did, you know? A little pull on the wine, got the wine going, got the pot going. Bingo. It happened. It hit, you know, just that realization, that spiritual awakening. That suddenly your head just says, "Well, hey, this is good. I feel good. I feel kind of calm, you know, and I don't feel calm, you know. I go from paralyzed, terrified victim to assassin, you know. Bang, bang, bang. I'm never anywhere in the middle. I don't know anything about the middle, you know? And that kind of just landed me right in the middle. And I thought, this is good, man. I don't know if it's the pot. I don't know if it's the wine. But I'm doing this as often as I possibly can. You know? They say, you know, people out there saying alcoholics are incapable of commitments. Bullshit, man. I made my commitment to drink and use no matter what, right there. There's a saying going around. I always say this. I always get in trouble for this. This saying, just don't drink or use no matter what. You know, they tell you that. They're kind of like condescending, kind of pat you on the head shit, you know. Just don't drink or use no matter what. I hate that. If I could just not drink or use no matter what, I sure as shit wouldn't come here. Why would I come here? Why would I sponsor all these guys that I sponsor? Why would I speak at meetings? I hate speaking. It scares me. When I came into AA, I'd been in AA 2.5 years, and I went up to my sponsor, you know, one of those great, you know, like you've made a decision kind of things. Went up to my sponsor and said, "I'll do anything you ask me to do in this goddamn program." I was a very loving guy when I got here. I said, "But I will never, ever, ever speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Period. That's it. I'm not discussing it with you." Right? Which is pretty funny. If you knew my sponsor, you know how ludicrous that was. And every time I would draw a line like that, he'd just say, "Time to step over it." He told me, he said, "You're afraid of people. and you're afraid to speak. What you're going to end up doing is here is you're going to end up speaking a lot and sponsoring a lot of guys. That's what you're going to end up doing. And I looked at him like, right. Well, that's the way it is. That's what happens. You got to walk through your biggest fears. You got to walk through them. So anyway, if I could just not drink or use no matter what, I wouldn't work the steps, and I wouldn't go to meetings, and I wouldn't do H&I, and I wouldn't go on panels, and I wouldn't take the call in the middle of the night, and I wouldn't do any of that stuff. I just wouldn't drink or use no matter what. But I can't. I'm the guy, I drink or use no matter what. I've got an obsession of the mind as well as a physical allergy. I have to do, something else has to happen for me. Or I drink. I'll get into that later anyway. So, pot and wine, humble beginnings. Humble beginnings, but boy, did it work. Boy, was that good. I loved it. And what I really loved about the beginning is that it did work. It did the job perfectly. It took the fear that I felt inside, and it just washed it off of me. And that's all I wanted. And the price I paid for that wonderful feeling was minimal. You know, I threw up on Steve's shoes. You know? I'm all right with that. Steve was loaded enough, he was all right with it. You know what I mean? It didn't make any difference. You know? What I've come to realize, though, is that slowly but surely, I mean, surely, it's an insidious process, that slowly but surely that the benefit I got from getting high and drinking became less and less and less and less and less. And the price that I paid for that high became greater and greater and greater and greater. And you'd think when those lines crossed, you know what I mean, and it was no longer worth it, you'd stop, right? Difference between a problem drinker and an alcoholic. Given a good reason, a problem drinker will stop. Given a good reason to stop, I keep going. I mean, you know, judge says to the problem drinker, I see you in my court one more time, you're doing a year. He says, well, shit, I'm not drinking anymore. I start thinking about going to jail, you know? Woman says, you don't stop drinking, I'm going to leave you. Problem drinker stops drinking. He loves her. He stops drinking. I start thinking about being single. Because I can't stop drinking. Nothing else is important. It's the number one priority. I drink and use no matter what. If you're going to make me pay a price, well, you're going to make me pay a price. All I do is resent you for making me pay that price and keep drinking. The resentment gives me another reason to keep drinking. So anyway, so I hung out in this boarding school. 13, I found pills. Any kind of pills, you know. My first love affair was 3 grand pharmaceutical, 2 and all. You know, identification in the room. A few people going, ooh, yeah, I remember that. 14, I started doing psychedelics. First time I did psychedelics, I was with the older woman. She was 15. And she said, you want to do some acid? And I said, sure. Having no idea what that meant. And she rolled up a lipstick tube, and out came this little tab on the end of it, right? I thought, that was clever. You know what I mean? It's a clever woman. And she just dialed up that lipstick, and there was that little acid there. And I just took it off the thing and put it in my mouth. And she said, did you take that whole thing? And I said, well, it was a little tiny, you know. You know, it was a little thing. She said, that was 3 hits of white lightning. And having no idea what that meant, I went, okay. So that was my introduction to psychedelics. Yeah. Now, 600 and some odd trips later, being declared legally insane by the military. That's another story. 15, I started shooting dope. You know, I'm not a specialist. You know, I didn't do one thing in here. Those of you that did one thing and just did it right into the dirt and came in here, God bless you, have a seat. My story's different. My drug of choice is, what do you got? What do you got? You got heroin? Terrific. Heroin's my favorite. I love heroin. I love that stuff. You know, any way you want to do it, fine with me. Want to shoot it, smoke it, snort it, I don't care. But then if you got gin, that's really, really terrific, because gin is my favorite. Really love gin. What do you got? You know, it's all anti-aerobic medication. Doesn't matter. Just different ways of getting it is killing the fear. I mean, that's what runs my life, is fear. I got this barrel of feelings and emotions, and, you know, I got lust and irritability and confusion and happiness and sadness and depression and all these. I got 3, 4, 5 of them going at any minute, you know, just swimming around there on the surface. But that deep undercurrent, you know, that stuff way down in the bottom that's running the show, that's fear. And that's what I drink at. I drink it to fear. So I got to drink through all that other stuff to get that down in the fear. So blackouts were normal for me. You know, passing out was normal for me because I'm going, heart and lungs working. That's the place I like. You know, that place where it just, what are you feeling? Absolutely nothing. Want to do anything? Nope. Want to go anywhere? Nope. I'm fine. I'm happy here. I remember when I was 15, I spent 3 months one summer on a boat in Marina del Rey shooting Demerol. We had, through a series of people, you know, make, you know how you make the connections. You know, this guy knows that guy is the sister of that guy who was married to that guy who was working for the doctor. Bingo. Bingo, right? We got vials, you know, of that, those bottles of Demerol, you know, and boxes of syringes, and we just, you know, got on the boat. Boat never left the dock, you know? Stayed hooked to the dock. I spent 3 months like this. On those little fold-down tables on the boat. That was where I was. You know, your head comes up, you know, just get another one in there and you're right back down on the table. I didn't feel a thing for 3 months, and it was the best party I ever went to in my life. I was partying, you know, heart and lungs working. And there was, I remember there was a nurse on the boat. This girl, one girl was a nurse. So everybody thought, oh, well, you know, nobody will OD with a nurse here. You know, she knows what's going on. Of course, she's the one that ODs, right? He's the total dope fiend. So 15, 16, I dropped out of high school. I quit high school. You know, 4.5 years of Latin was enough. I'd had enough Latin. I was using it a lot. And I just said, I quit. This is stupid. I quit. And my father came back in my life and said, you've obviously gone insane. And threw me in my first nut house. So I ended up in an intensive psychotherapeutic lock ward with really crazy people. You know, I didn't see myself as being crazy. Of course, they had me in there for 3 months of observation and a year of rehabilitation. And I was kind of upset about that. I thought that was a little extreme, you know. So I was in there, and you get 3 cups of pills a day and a shot, right? So, of course, the only reason I'm in there, I'm just figuring out a new way every day to get the shot. You got to, you know, you got to act out and you got to cause problems so they give you the shot to calm you down. Because a calm patient is a good patient, right? They don't want anybody with any opinions or anything back in those days. You know, you just drug you up, you shuffle around in the, you know, shuffle around in the place and you talk to a psychiatrist every day, you know, shuffle around. And I was excited I was going to make my break. These signs remind me of it. They have these green exit signs that are lit up that they got in here. They had them in this mental institution I was in. And I used to sit around and just look at that and go, yeah, exit. That's what I want to do. That's all anybody wants to do. And I remember sitting at this table, and I didn't know I was in those 3 cups of pills they'd been giving me all this time, right? And I'm just shuffling around in this hospital for a few weeks. I decided I'm going to bust out of this place. I'm sitting in the cafeteria. Everybody's eating lunch, you know, and I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to make my move, man. I am out of here. Ready? Ready? Go! You know? And I was hauling ass, you know what I mean? That was I had the arms working and everything, you know what I mean? I'm busting out, you know? The old Thorazine shuffle. And you hear over the loudspeaker from the nurse's station, Ed, when you got a second, you want to grab Earl? He's making a break for the door. You know what I mean? And it's like so demoralizing, you know, because you look over your shoulder, you're working, you look over your shoulder to check out how fast Ed's coming, you know. Ed's taking another bite of his sandwich first, you know what I mean? Ed's not in any big hurry. You ain't going anywhere, Jack. But I mean, defiant, alcoholic, you know what I mean? I mean, like a normal, sane person realizes at this point, this is stupid, you lose. Go sit down and finish your Jell-O. You're not going. You're staying here, you know? No, man, my attitude is, fuck you, Ed. You want me, you gotta come get me, man. And I worked till Ed came and got me and took me back to my room with no doorknob. And I told Ed the whole way back to the room, it's your fault, Ed. It's your fault. There wasn't anybody else around to blame, so it was Ed's fault. So I talked my way out of there after a while, and then I was out on the street for a while, and then they threw a net over me again and threw me back into another place. But I had tools for living now. I had drugs. I had alcohol. I had violence. I had run. And I had the information that if you get thrown in the nut house, you got to get out before they get the Thorazine in you. Intake process, I'm sitting there telling them how happy I am that they have gotten a hold of me because it is terrible out there. Hey, look at that. hauling ass out the back, out following those exit signs of the earth, ding, 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 man, through those doors, intern on my tail, out in the backyard, running across the lawn. I'm going, I got a little theme song going in my head. It's like a, it's a big game to me, right? I'm like, you know, this guy on my tail. At that moment in my life, I'm like 16 and a half, 17 years old. I'm a high school dropout. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a drug addict. And at any moment, hopefully an escaped mental patient. That's my life. That's my life. I mean, that's who I am, you know? And I'm thinking, if I make that fence, I don't have a problem. I don't have any problems, because I'll be loaded in 20 minutes, and that's all that matters. You got to know what you want in life. I want to drink. I want to use. That's what I want to do. And I'm willing to, and I'm so, up to this point, I'm willing to pay the price. I'm willing to pay the price. Spent 3 years out on the streets through a series of circumstances only an alcoholic can create. I ended up, I got accepted to a very good business college in Northern California. I didn't even have a high school diploma. You know what I'm saying? Went back to my father, said, listen, I got accepted to college. Don't ask. Kick me the tuition. I'm out of town. He said, beautiful. Wrote the check. Me and this woman that I'd met at a party, and we decided that we were in love and we were going to be Ozzy and Harriet forever. You know, we threw all of our belongings and 8 pounds of hash in the back of this truck and drove to Northern California to higher learning. I was going to college. Gave him a check for the year's tuition, told him the transcripts were in the mail, went down to local high school, did the GED stuff to get my high school diploma going, you know. By the time I was a junior in college, my using was nuts. It was nuts. She had to go because she didn't get it. She didn't understand. She was trying to have a relationship. You know, she was asking those trick questions that women ask you. You know, like I'd come home from a hard day of classes and drug dealing on campus, you know, and I'd come in and she'd, I'm tired, you know. I need to get high again. And she would say, how are you doing? How are you, Earl? How was your day? These are trick questions. Because you're going to say, I'm fine. How are you? What did you do today? I mean, we're going to talk to each other, you know? We're going to talk. We're going to get to know each other. We're going to learn all about each other. She's going to find out I'm a liar. I'm a thief. I'm a total fraud. I'm afraid of everything and everybody. This is all just a big facade that I've got going here. I got a high school diploma. I'm going to college. I got an acceptance to go to law school. I'm not interested in any of this shit. This is just to keep you off my back so I can keep drinking and using the way I want to. I have my priorities straightened out. That's what I want to do. And if doing these things will keep you off my back, then I'll do them. And she said something real. I remember one time we had some people over for dinner, which was an excuse for them to bring their stuff over so we could get high. And they left, and I closed the door, and I turned around, and I looked at her across the apartment. She looked at me, and she said, I'm too high. Well, if you can say it, it's not true, right? She didn't get it. Gotta go. We're friends to this day. Actually, I met her at another party like 3 years later, and she asked me if she could do anything for me, and I said, yeah, get me a drink and marry me. I was just being an idiot. And she came back and said, here's your drink. Yeah, I'll marry you. I said, all right. So we got a marriage license, blood test, and we went and we had this wedding and this big reception, and we got married. It was great. And I said, that was really cool. See you. We never even went home with each other after the wedding. I just wandered off and went the other way. And she just thought, and she just looked at me like, you know, she thinks that's hysterical. This is kind of right, Alan on his ring. She just thought that was just so Earl, you know. He just wandered off. I did. I had a roommate one time. I went across the street, literally across the street, to get a six-pack of beer. I don't even like beer. I came back 2 weeks later with a girl from Milan that I introduced him to. And I woke him up in the middle of the night, and I said, hi, this is Milan. And because I could never remember her name. So but I liked that she was from Milan. I still remember that. So I was just from Milan. I'd been gone 2 weeks, and he said I was going to be worried if you weren't back in a couple more days. And that struck me, you know. I thought I was going to get a lot of shit for being gone so long and not telling anybody where I went. But they were, you know, I'd just disappear for a couple weeks and come back, and just everybody got used to it that was around me. Anyway, so I'm doing this college thing. Turns out I have malignant cancer. fly back to L.A., have major surgery on my back, do the nuclear medicine. They prepare my family for me to die. They prepare me to die. And I think, you don't even know who you're talking to. Prepare me to die. You know what I mean? Like, I run that risk maybe two nights a week. You know? You're not really threatening me. You're not scaring me. Plus, it was dramatic, you know? And you know how we love the drama. You know, I'm in your house now. I mean, I got some great tools now. This is getting good as far as I'm concerned because I'm needing some more dramatic shit. Right? I'm in your house now. I'm snorting all your cocaine, drinking all your wine, you know, just being an asshole in your house. And you come up to me and say, you know what, Earl, man, your behavior is out of line. Excuse me. I have cancer. Dealing with some very heavy shit over here. If you'd like to know how I'm dealing with it, you know, just bring that. I saw the bottle you were nursing over there. Just bring that bottle over here. We'll sit down and have a few drinks and talk about it. I remember the first time I've said that from the podium, where I would use that out there. Excuse me, I got cancer. You know, I'm dealing with that. This woman in the room went, oh, my God, that's sick. And I thought, now you're getting it. Now you're starting to understand. I have this disease called alcoholism. I will say or do whatever is necessary. When you come up to me and tell me I'm out of line, what I hear is, you're cut off. You don't get anymore. You've really scared me now. And I will say or do whatever is necessary to get back in line for some more. And if telling you, if all I've got to do is pull out the high drama stuff to get you to lighten up and let me have another drink, I'll say it. It doesn't make any difference to me. I'll say whatever is necessary to keep drinking. So anyway, so I beat that. I go back up to school. School's not going real well. I mean, I'm hanging in. I'm doing okay, but I'm just trying to get by. I'm just trying to get it over with. My mother calls me from L.A. and says, we haven't been anywhere as a family for 10 years. Your birthday's coming up. Let's go somewhere as a family. You know, pulling all the mother tricks, right? She's crying. She's begging, you know. All right. Fly back to L.A. Get in my father's plane to fly to Guadalajara, and on the way there, the plane crashed. And my mother, my father, my little sister were all killed, and I wasn't. And I woke up on this mountain in Mexico, and that was the weird part, was waking up, you know, because you're falling out of the sky, and you know it's over. You know it's over, you know, and you think weird stuff when, like, this is it. And I just looked around in this plane, you know what I mean, and thought, well, we're going to die. And I looked, all I wanted to know was how fast was I going when I died. So I was looking at the air knot gauge to see how fast I was going. I was going 160. And blam, we hit the earth, you know, and then I woke up. Next thing I knew, I wake up, and my skull was fractured, and my back was broken in three places, and I was paralyzed from the waist down, and I had a crush, my arm was crushed, and my leg was crushed, and I was conscious. And I couldn't move. And I looked around, and it was my mother, my father, and my little sister all laying there, and I couldn't move, I couldn't do anything for them, and I just watched them all bleed to death. And I swore I would never love another human being again as long as I lived. And I would never, ever tell you who I am. There's no way I'm going to let you love me. I'm out of the game. I don't need the game anymore. I don't need the facade anymore. I got all the excuses I need to drink and use until I die, and that's all I'm looking for. I've never been any good at this life thing anyway. I've never been any good at the chit-chat, making friends, being with people. I've been afraid of everybody all my life. I don't know how to do this shit, this living stuff anyway. I've been underground my whole life. My whole life, you know what I mean? I've never done it like other people did it. And I always felt less than, and I never felt like I fit in, and I never belonged. Wherever I was, I didn't feel like I belonged. You know, the only thing that worked was getting high. So screw it. I quit. And I was real angry, and they got me up. I don't know how long I was up there, but they got me up the mountain. Oh, and while I was up on the mountain, some guys came up, and I could move my right arm. That was the only thing I could move. And these guys came up, and I could see them, and I thought, well, we're saved. And I took my wallet out, and I put it on my chest. Like my identification, you know? And this guy came over and picked up my wallet and he took the money out of it and he put the wallet back on my chest. They were just, you know, scavenging the plane crash and then they all took off back down the hill. So man's inhumanity to man was just real clear to me. I mean, I had no use for anybody after an experience like that. I didn't want to play. I came off that mountain real angry and real shut down and real, real crazy. And they patched me up. First they took me to a Red Cross station and they tagged me. Put a tag on my toe, waited for me to die, which upset me. You know, and then they finally took me to a hospital and they plastered me from the neck down and threw me on a plane. They interrogated me for 3.5 days and for some other stuff. That's another story. And then threw me on a plane and flew me back to the States. I spent some time in a hospital, and I walked out of that hospital angry, 128 pounds, and crazy. And I drank and used for another 4.5 years. And a lot of war stories. Everybody's got them, you know, stabbed twice, shot at, violent, crazy, blackouts, waking up in other cities, waking up in conversations with cops. That I hated that one. You know, when I came out of a blackout on, you'll love this one. I came out of a blackout on Speedway in Venice, California. Not a good place to be. Stone cold sober with a gun in your pocket. Not a good place to be. I like, bing, and I got four cops standing in front of me, and they're talking to me, and I have no. You know, the thought in your head is, I did it again. You know, I did it again, but you've been in black. You've had 100 blackouts. You know, you just figure, okay, just be calm, and eventually you'll get an idea what we're here for, what's going on. You know, but I mean, what are you supposed to do? You just play dumb. You just stand there. You know what I mean? What are you going to say? Excuse me, officers, I just got here. I know you think I was here, but I wasn't. I wasn't here. And whatever it was I did, I didn't do it because I wasn't here. Right. It's going to go well. Blackouts, blackouts, blackouts. You know, crazy, crazy, crazy. Went, by the time I got, came to that moment of clarity where there was nothing left. There was nothing left. I detoxed 3 times, drunk the night I got out. People were saying to me, you need to stop drinking. I was saying, fine, how? How? Tell me how. Somebody tell me how to stop. I don't know how to stop. I've known I was an alcoholic for years. I know I'm a drug addict for 10 years. I've been drinking and using it on a daily basis for 16 years. How? Don't know how to do anything else. I don't know how to stop. I know how to get more. That's what I know how to do. So I came out of it this last one, man, and it was over. My bottom is of a spiritual nature. You know what I mean? I mean, I think that the bottom for most alcoholics is dead. That's the bottom. You know, physically. The bottom I hit was of an emotional and spiritual nature. I came out of that blackout and it hit me clear as day. I'd known in my mind that I was completely alone in the world. My family was dead. I had no friends. I was unemployable. It was over. I had no place to live. I had a few clothes, no money, a 1968 Volkswagen that no one in their right mind would get in. That was it. That was it. I just burned every bridge there was in the world. And I had no tools for living left at work. It was over. I'd known that in my head for a while, but what I experienced that morning was that I was completely alone in the world. I felt completely alone in the world, and I had no fight left. I had no fight left. My ass was kicked. It was over. My disease had beaten me into a state of reasonableness, like it says in the book. And this woman that I took me to an emergency room, and they pumped my stomach and said, get him out of here, he's going to die. So they took me by ambulance to another center in the valley. They kept me for 3 days. I got worse. They put me in an ambulance and drove me down to Long Beach. And they kept me there for 12 more days of detox and then a 30-day rehab on a free bed. And I just didn't know. I was just crazy, man. I was crazy. I had some real nasty pictures in my head. I had no trust of human beings. I had no love left in me. I was a hopeless, low-bottom, alcoholic dope fiend with nowhere to go. Perfect. Now for the hard part. The hard part was come out of that hospital and don't drink. I had a lot of information when I came out of that hospital, but I'd had a lot of information before I went in there. What I was terrified once again, and through a series of circumstances that too long to explain, I ended up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I came in, I did not come here because I wanted what you had. I had no idea what you had. I didn't know anything about this. How could I want what you had? All I knew was is that supposedly there were these people that drank and used like I did, and they were staying sober. They were staying clean one day at a time. That was one of the first things I heard. I came in the back, and I sat down, my arms folded with my best fuck you, get away from me look on my face, you know? I'm a very tough person. Stay away from me. Right? Which impressed no one, you know? And this guy walks up to me and said, hi, I'm Vegas. I'm an alcoholic. And I said, so what? You know, an alcoholic is not exactly the high point of my life. I don't know what you're bragging about. You know, get away from me. Get away from me. I have tools for living, you know, but none of them work anymore. You know, I can't drink. I can't use. I got no violence left in me. I can't run anymore. I'm like dead in the water over here, man. And you're all smiley and shiny and polished. And, you know, I don't trust you, you know. And I don't like you either. And he just looked at me and smiled and said, keep coming back. You know, I mean, the only thing he didn't do was just pat me on the head and say, you're a terribly frightening individual. You know, please come back. You're scaring the hell out of everybody. You're all right. And I thought, shit, you know, I'm in here 15 seconds and my cover's blown, you know. And everybody knows I'm just a terrified human being who doesn't know how to be in the world, doesn't know how to get through a day. I mean, I would wake up in the morning and think, oh, my God, you know, head after me, you know. Glad to see you're up. A few things we want to talk to you about. You're a piece of shit. You should be dead. We don't even know what you're still doing here. You know what I'm saying? I mean, they flew the plane to Mexico for your birthday. It's your goddamn fault they're all dead. Don't you get it, Earl? You're not even supposed to be alive. You're not even supposed to be on the planet. You have no right to be here, you miserable piece of shit. You know? And I'm like going, okay, take a shower. Okay, take a shower. You know? And another thing. You know what I mean? And it's just... You know? Just slamming away at myself. All I'm doing every day is trying to get tired enough to go back to sleep. I just want to go back to sleep. You know? At sleep, they attack you one thing at a time. You know? You have really weird dreams. You know, you relive the plane crash. Well, you get. I got used to it. I got numbed to it. You know, that's how many times I would right up to the hit in my sleep and, you know, come out of it swinging, you know? And then remember that I can't get up, get in the car, and go drive to a bar. I can't. I just got to be here. And who am I going to talk to about this? Who am I going to talk to about this? Right? I was so lost. I was so crazy. And I'm sitting in these rooms, and these people just sort of, I was like the shadow guy. You know what I mean? I became the shadow man. I wouldn't let anybody touch me. Didn't really want to talk to anybody. But for God's sakes, don't leave me alone. You know? Coffee after the minute, they say, okay, you know, there'll be a guy standing here, and say, okay, it's time to go to coffee. They say, okay, you know, all right, begrudgingly, right? I couldn't say, thank God you asked me, because I'm dying over here. I was like, yeah, okay, we'll go to coffee, right? Like, I got a very heavy social calendar, you know? Like, I got a lot of other things I need to be doing, you know? And we'd go, you know, and it would be like, okay, here we go, you know? And I'd just be right behind this guy. But don't, you know, don't get too close. So we'd be walking, and we'd, you know, Don't touch me. Don't get too close. Just don't go away. Don't get too close. Just don't go away. Don't leave me alone, man. I've been alone for so long. When I got in this program, it had been so long since I had talked to somebody. I didn't know how to do it. You know, I didn't share from a podium. I never took a chip. I didn't take a cake till I was three. I didn't share from a podium till I was 2 and a half. And the only reason I did it is my sponsor said to me, you're the first speaker here next. He did it the day I said to him, I'll never speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, that's a lovely sentiment. And you're the first speaker here next Saturday night. I'd draw the line. He'd say, time to cross it. You have to be willing to go to any lengths, Earl. Any time that you say, I'll do everything here but this, time to do it. Time to do it. You know, and I didn't do that till I was 2 and a half. And I mean, I didn't pee on myself or black out, so it was a success. You know what I mean? And I was so grateful it was a podium like this, because, man, my legs were humming. You know, I could just hold on. Hi, I'm Earl. I'm an alcoholic. Everybody says, hi, Earl, you know, and you go into like a whiteout. God, it was scary. It was so scary, because I knew you were going to find out who I was, and you were going to throw me away like my father did. And I don't want to play that game anymore, and I don't have any place else left to go. Where the hell am I going to go? There's no place left. I have to make it here. I have to make it here. They told me, you drink again, you're going to die. We're not telling you that to scare you, Earl. You're going to die. That's it. And I kept thinking, in my head saying, they're just being dramatic. They're just being dramatic. 2:15, yellow, hair out to here, beard out like this. I look like a psychotic little Buddha running around. You know what I mean? I was out of my mind. Out of my mind. And I started hanging around in here, and I started hearing these things that people saying, keep coming back, one day at a time. Just don't drink or use no matter what. I hate that one. Turn it over. You know? Yeah. Don't you love that? Don't you love that? I mean, these people were pissing me off. You know what I mean? Keep coming back. Okay, where? Turn it over. Fine. Turn what over? What does that mean? easy does it. Fuck you. You easy does it. I was scared. I didn't know what to do. They were looking at me like I was supposed to understand this. If you're new and you don't understand all the stuff you hear around here, perfect. You're doing great. If you're willing to be here and not get it, you got more balls than anybody else in the room. God bless you, man. I mean, that's like the most powerful thing in the world is a 30-day chip. Blows my mind. People get up and say, well, you know, I dropped all the old ways, and I don't know how to be in here yet at all, but I got 30 days. Wow. Really impressive to me. Really impressive to me. So anyway, I'm hearing all this stuff, you know, and then this woman says to me, you got to get a sponsor. I said, okay, what's a sponsor? And they said, sponsor somebody who's got what you want. I said, stop that. Okay, what do I want? Find somebody that's good at their life. Somebody who's happy being who they are. Somebody who's got a passion for living. Got a little excitement and I'm out there doing it. Go find somebody like that. Great. You know, it's amazing that if they had any idea what was going on in my head, they would have just said, never mind, we'll get you someone. Never mind. Don't involve his best thinking. It'll get ugly fast. So I went and I found this guy. Godshot. I went and found this guy. Guy's nuts. Had about 10 years, right? He's a crazy person. Had more passion for living. He was so good at being himself. He had so much focus and clarity, and he was in the world. And he wasn't one of these James Dean hangback guys, you know what I mean? You know, I'm feeling a little pain, a little angst, but no, I don't want to talk about it. You know, I got a hanging back guy. No, man, none of this bullshit. This guy was in the world. He felt strongly about things, and if you asked him, he would tell you. I respected that. I thought that was cool. I asked him, I went up to him and said, he said, what? I said, would you be my sponsor? He said, yes. This is how he talks. He talks like this. He said, yes. And let me tell you something, mister. You don't have to like what I tell you, and you don't have to think it's a good idea. You just have to do it. I thought, all right, I could do that. So we went to a meeting, and he said, they make 550 cups of coffee here every Friday night, and you're going to make them for the next year. I said, fuck you. Well, not. You don't seem to understand the nature of my problem. I wake up every morning, and I'm out of my goddamn mind. I'm ready to kill myself or somebody else at any moment. All I'm trying to do is get tired enough to go back to sleep. I'm crazy. I'm in agony all the time. I don't know how to be in the world. I'm so alone. I'm starting to feel some feelings now, and all I feel is loneliness. If I were an honest person, when I opened my mouth, all I would do is scream. I would just scream. That would say it better than any words I could put on how I'm feeling. You obviously don't understand where I'm at. Right? He just said, make the coffee or drink. Oh, God, you know. I mean, these guys, they're so dramatic about it, you know. I just wanted to talk about it, you know. And he goes right to the bottom line with, okay, then drink, you little shit. Okay, you know, so I make the coffee. And what I didn't understand was, remarkable gift the man was giving me. And he could have said to me at that point, go, you know, Earl, here's the deal, you self-centered maniac. You've never thought of anybody but yourself in your life. Self-centered fear is the chief activator of all your defects of character. You don't know how to think about anybody but you. Because you're afraid you're going to lose something you've got, or you're afraid you're not going to get something you want. Self-centered fear got you going all the time. Right? What I'm going to do is I'm going to give you an opportunity to get out of yourself. You're going to learn about service. You're going to go make coffee for these people every Friday night. It's about a 4.5-hour commitment. And you're going to be thinking about them. And you're going to be worrying about this and then this and then this and then this and then this. You're going to be busy for 4.5 hours. At the end of that 4.5 hours, you'll feel better. Because you won't have been thinking about Earl. That would have just gone, wouldn't have understood any of that. You know? So he said, make the coffee or drink. He spoke to me in a language I understood. He used to yell at me a lot. I'd be standing across a meeting, Ohio Street, Saturday nights, right? I'd be standing across I had the cleanup commitment at that one. Standing across the meeting, right? I'm doing nothing, right? And then all of a sudden I'd hear, Earl! And I was very jumpy, you know what I mean? It was just, oh, shit! What? And when I was about 5 years sober, he said to me, you know, I used to yell at you all the time. He said, all I was yelling at you for is that I knew how loud it was in your head. I was just yelling over your head. And it was true. I mean, he'd just yell over all the noise going on in here. He'd always get my attention. I always knew when Donald would show up. Donald M. He's the same sponsor. Yeah, you know, I've had one sponsor my whole sobriety, 11 and a half years. Him. Remarkable guy. Remarkable. I'm alive because of that man. Period. I trusted no human beings at all when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I realized early on that I had to make a conscious decision to trust one human being or I was going to die. I had to hook up. I had to make a conscious decision to trust somebody. I decided to trust him. Amazing. Amazing human being. Loved me when there was nobody home to love. Took care of me, you know, was hard on me when I needed it, you know, took me down a notch when I needed to be taken down, would love me up when I needed to be bolstered up, you know what I mean? And never asked me to do anything he wasn't doing. What he showed me was before there was a book, before there was anything, there was one alcoholic working with another. That's where it was at, working with another alcoholic, giving it away. And he took me to me, we're going to a meeting. Okay. We'd go to a meeting. You know, he'd yell at the speakers. He doesn't do that anymore. He gave me so much. I mean, I didn't know how to do anything in the world. I showed up. He had a factory downtown, and I showed up at his factory one day. I said, I don't know what to do. He said, paint the factory. He went back in the, you know. So I started painting this big factory, you know, two-story factory. I'd paint all day long, and I'd go in and give me some money, and I'd go get something to eat, and go to a meeting, go to bed, get up, and come back to the factory. Painted the whole outside of this factory, me and these other guys. We were all done. I said, I was terrified, because the factory was painted now. I said, what do? He said, paint the inside of the factory. All right? So we worked, and we worked, and we worked, and painted the whole inside of this factory. When it was done, he said, you know how to paint. Go get a job. Yeah? Guy gave me a way to go out and make a living. I had a college education. I was a smart little sucker, right? But, I mean, what I needed was I needed for somebody to tell me at that point in my life, I need to think about staying sober. I don't need to be thinking about anything else. I need to think about staying sober. And they'd put me in a room and they'd say, paint that wall. I'd say, got it. Paint the wall. Painting the wall. What are you doing? I'm painting the wall. Painted a lot of walls. Lots of walls. 4.5 years, I was a house painter. It's absolutely nothing to do with my creativity as a man or who I am or what's good for me. What I was at 4.5 years of painting houses was I was sober because I was in a meeting at night and I was learning how to do these things. And I started to find out because of my sponsor and other people what this stuff meant. Keep coming back. I knew what they meant one day at a time. Had a glimpse of that one. A glimpse of that one. Because right here, right now, is the last place I want to be. Because I got to be Earl right here. I'm off in the future thinking about grandiose things, or I'm worrying if you're going to find out about what I did last week. You know, I'm in the past and I'm in the future. Being right here right now is impossible for me. It's the most scary place on earth. And I was getting closer and closer and closer to being here. Wasn't loving anybody, wasn't being loved, didn't get close to people, wasn't having relationships of any substance, but I was sober. I was sober. Unbelievable. 6.5, you know, and then I got another job. My job turned into a career, doing a little public relations thing. You know what I mean? I was dating, and I had a nice little place to live. I had a car other people would get in now, you know? I mean, and the little stuff that you never would tell anybody that meant so much to me. To have my sponsor call me and say, go pick up Ed on the corner, take him to a meeting. I could actually take the car I had now, I could go pick up Ed, and Ed could sit in the seat next to me, you know? And I could be driving along, and I could look to my right, and I could say, so how's it going, Ed? That means nothing to anybody. That meant a lot to me. That meant a lot to me. Just to be able to do those little things. One of the things I'm so grateful for my life, for the devastation and the annihilation of the hopelessness of my life then and the way it is now, is that I don't take for granted a lot of things that a lot of people do take for granted. I don't. Because I had them all taken away from me. They say the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Read it tonight. Some of us pursue it to the gates of insanity and death. They're locking my ass up left and right in the nut houses. They had me tagged in Mexico waiting to send me to the... I've been to the gates. They're big, big gates. I don't want to go there anymore. I don't want to go there. I want to stay here. I'm willing to do whatever it takes to stay here because I got everything back and more. I had a family that I was not very close to. I was alienated from at an early age. I felt they'd throw me away, so I didn't stay real close. I have a new family now. You know, I'm not bound to them by blood. I'm bound to them by a spiritual path. I'm closer to these people than any people I've ever been. I'm loving and being loved. I'm having a great time. I'm doing a lot of things. But I hit 6.5 years and I went crazy. I went crazy. Shaky, man. I got shaky. And I went to an old timer and I said, "What is up, man?" The guy said, "Well, Earl, if you knew, watch these old timers, man. They will mess you up." I went up to this guy and said, "What's the deal?" He says, "Well, Earl, I watched you come in. And if you don't get a program, you're going to die." So what are you talking about, man? I'm sponsoring 10 guys. I'm speaking once a week. I go to 7 to 9 meetings. I got 2 H&I panels. Yickety, yickety, yick. Right? He said, "Like I said, you don't get a program, you're going to die." So what are you talking about? He says, "Earl, that's all very, very good stuff. That's the fellowship. Got to have it. Great stuff. You need a program. It's called Steps. You'll find them in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I suggest you check it out." Turns around and walks away. Right? He was bored with me. So... all right, got a buddy of mine. He was 8, I was 6.5, Christopher. And we got my best friend. Amazing man, amazing man. We got together, opened up the book, said, "We're new. Let's go." What's his first step? And then on the cover, there's this circle with a triangle, Unity, Recovery, and Service. So that seemed to be the key to the whole deal. That's an ancient spiritual symbol, mind, body, and spirit brought together as a whole human being. And that there was balance indicated there, and it was balance that I needed in my life. You know, I'm victim assassin. You know what I mean? I got no balance. I got no calm. I got no peace. I got no contentment. I don't have the peace and contentment that came with those first few drinks. It's all gone. I haven't had access to that anymore. Okay. Balance. So what's the unity? Unity is the body. Bring it here. Sit down, shut up, and listen. That's what they told me. It worked. It worked. Bring the body here. Got to hook up with my people. I can't be alone. I got to be with you. I can't isolate. This starts talking again. You know, the guy comes back. The voice comes back. I don't want that stuff in my head anymore. If that's bring the body here. If that's it, that's all I have to do, right? Well, if that were true, I could just put the drink down, right? And I don't have a problem anymore, right? If that were true, detox centers would be kicking out winners, man. 72 hours and free. All I have to do is kick and wouldn't have a problem. But I got an obsession of the mind as well. So for me, it's about not starting again. I got to learn how to not start again. That's the recovery. The recovery is of the mind. Unity is the body. I bring it into the meetings. Do the stuff that they have me doing here. Recoveries of the mind. That's the 164 pages of the big book. And that's where the steps are. And that's where it tells me how to do them. 12 and 12 is a beautiful book. I love that book. It tells me a lot about the steps. But first I got to learn how to do them. That's in the big book. So we start on the steps. What's step one? Turns out step one was, what's the problem? You got to know what the problem is before you start looking for a solution. Problem is, I'm powerless. Lack of power is my dilemma. I am an alcoholic. It says on page 30, I must accept to my innermost self that I am alcoholic. That is the first step in recovery. That's what I had to do. So we worked on that. If that's the problem, what's the solution? Step two, that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Hasn't done it yet, but could I come to believe that that was possible? Yeah, I believe that that's possible. That a power greater than me that could restore me to sanity. Soundness of mind. Relieve this obsessiveness. Deal with the mental aspect of my disease. Whole point of the steps. Spiritual awakening to restore me to sanity. Soundness of mind. Relieve the obsession of drink and use. That's the only point. Whole point of the steps. Cool. I know that. Self-knowledge. One, two, drink. Now what? So I better do step three. I better make a decision to do something about it. They told me it was a plan. It was a program of action. I thought the action was scurrying around in here. That's what I thought. Make a decision. To do what? Turn it over. Turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand them. That's what I was supposed to turn over. You know, wish somebody told me. You know? Fact is, I'd probably heard it 1,000 times. You know what I mean? But it just bounced off. So embark upon this. You know, having made a decision, I need to embark upon a rigorous course of action. Immediately. 4 through 9, this action plan that I'm going to do that's going to clear away all this shit I have piled up in my life that I put between me and you and me and God. And those, you're the only two I got. You and God's all that's available. I got me, you, and God. And I had you guys blocked off. Real good. I was great. You know, if you're black, you don't understand. If you're Mexican, you don't understand. If you're a woman, you don't understand. If you're gay, you don't understand. If you're 5 years older plus, you don't understand it. Younger, you don't understand. I mean, you just keep circling the wagons tighter and tighter and tighter. You know, if you're not Earl, you don't understand. I was cut off from everybody. So I'm going to work this plan of action that's going to take, it's going to peel all that crap off of me. All right? 4 through 9. Do a thorough four-step in the book. I got 4 through 9 laying in black and white right in front of me. 10, 11, and 12 are going to keep me in the game. Promises start happening. They've started happening way before that. They said, you'll be amazed before you're halfway through. And I was at step 5. I was amazed at what was going on in my life, how I was starting to feel different, that maybe I could start to hook up with other human beings on some kind of a substantial level. It was starting to happen, you know? It was starting. 10, 11, and 12 are going to keep me in this game. 10 is me, 11 is God, and 12 is you. Keep my side of the street clean in 10. 11, seek through prayer and meditation, conscious contact. What am I going to pray for? Knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. That's it. You don't pray for her anymore, the money, the cash, the money, property, and prestige are great. I'm all for them, as my friend Bill says. Money, property, well, see, I heard him in the podium, he goes, what's all this I hear about money, property, and prestige? I think it's wonderful. Just can't come first. Can't come first. This got to come first. This has got to come first. So, 11, seek your prayer and meditation. Conscious contact, like I'm waking up now, I'm waking up. Knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out, keeping it simple, keeping it simple. 12, having had a spiritual awakening is the result, only point, of doing these steps, I can carry the message. Third side of the triangle, unity is the body, I bring it here. Recovery is of the mind, I work the steps. Having had a spiritual awakening is the result of doing it, service, spiritual. I can be of service. But I can't give away something I don't have. Can't give away something I don't have. So I got to go do the work. It was the first time I felt like guys would walk up to me and they'd say, I heard you speak. That's great. Will you sponsor me? Can you know how to stay sober? I felt like I could look them right in the eye and say, yeah. Because it's no longer as Earl sees it. Here's the book. It ain't about me. It's not about me, man. They say, I like you. You help me stay sober. Well, it ain't about me, man. Everything I got going in my life that's of value as regards my staying clean and sober a day at a time is out of that book and out of the mouths of other men and women in this program who came before me, who kept it simple for me, who kept me back on track, didn't get me into the pop psychology or all this other stuff. I'm an alcoholic, Alcoholics Anonymous. This is where I stay sober. These are my people. I don't got to go find a better class of people. I don't have to go find a more sophisticated way of saying what's said here. This is the place for me. This is it. So I did all that stuff and my life changed completely as a result of doing it. And I'm having a blast. Having a very good time. I got the same sponsor, long-term relationship. Amazing man. I love, absolutely love him to death. There's hope for me now. I'm no longer a hopeless individual. I have hope. I'm able to be in the moment. I'm here with you guys in this room right now, and I'm real comfortable doing it. You know, because this is the only place that's right now is all there is. This is all there is right now. There isn't anything else. There's nothing else. This is all there is. And I have enough right now. And I am sober right now. And I feel love right now. Right now. Right now. It's great, man. It's great. I mean, where else am I going to find God? God's now. Love is now. My dignity as a man is now. My ability to be strong enough to be gentle with myself and with other human beings is now. Guy that I sponsored for a long time here, for 6 years, just went out and got drunk. I got real pissed off at him. Real pissed off at him. Self-centered fear. He scared me when he did it. Recognized it immediately. And called him up and told him that I loved him and I was here if he needed me. Because I don't know what anybody else's path is supposed to be. I don't know what anybody else is supposed to do. For all I know, he's going to stay sober and be president of the United States. You know, I don't know. It's not my job to know. It's what my job is that if an alcoholic or a drug addict reaches out to AA for help, I extend my hand. That's my job. That's what I do. So you want to go to a meeting? You want to talk about recovery? Come on, man. Come on. You want to talk solution? Let's go. And love them. Like the people that loved me when I came in here, when I didn't have anything anybody wanted. As another guy I know says, I was no vision for you when I got here. Oh, Mickey. So anyway, I guess what I'm trying to say is if you're new, congratulations. This thing is way more than about not drinking and using. It's a design for living. And that's why I started drinking in the first place. I was restless, irritable, and discontented long before I ever took a drink. Drink was the answer, became the solution. It's a lot deeper than that. You know, there's the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and there's, you know, the Way of the Peaceful Warrior and the Mustard Seed and Sermon on the Mount and the Bible. And I mean, great stuff. It's great stuff. All these paths to God, you know, wonderful stuff. Great stuff to talk about, too. But the deal about this is a program of action. This is my opinion. This has got it all beat. Because this is about the demonstration and the practice of these principles on a daily basis. One alcoholic gets down in the dirt with another alcoholic. These two people have a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. They're going to die. Best medical mind in the world. Going to die. Can't make it. They share their experience, strength, and hope together, and they rise up out of this seemingly hopeless state. That's the most powerful thing I've ever seen in my life. It goes way past not drinking and using. It has to do with the spiritual path and the way we live our lives and the dignity that we find and the service that we're able to give. It's a spiritual path, man. It is beautiful. And what I'm convinced of is that when I came in here, the price I paid to stay here was tremendous initially. And the relief I got was minimal. It was the exact opposite of drinking and using. Exact opposite. The longer I stay here, the easier it is to stay, and the greater the reward and the joy. So what does that tell me? What's ahead? If I can stay right here, if I can keep coming back to now, what's ahead of me is greater love, greater dignity as a man, greater joy, a greater sense of peace, a greater sense of community and family with the people in this program and with the people on the planet. You know, that's what's ahead of me. If I just, all I got to do is keep it simple. I got to do the things that are outlined in the 12 steps and be of service on a daily basis, and I'm going to be okay and accept God's will for me in my life and just move through my life. I don't know what's going to happen in my life. It's just my commitment is to show up and find out what happens. I don't carry a dead family around with me anymore. I don't carry those people around. I don't carry the cancer around. I'm having a really good time. I'm having a really good time, and I'm very happy to be up here with you guys tonight, and I'm going to shut my mouth. Peace.